My friends, no story ever written for the screen is as dramatic as the story of the screen itself.
This is the 12th episode of The History of Film, Edwin S. Porter and Parallel Editing. Welcome back to The History of Film, and welcome back to the United States. We've spent quite a long time in this show in Britain and France from episodes 5 to 11, but now we journey back across the Atlantic to the east coast of the U.S. to catch up with emerging filmmakers and film technologies there. We will be spending the next several episodes here, so get comfortable. But before we begin talking about filmmakers and their movies, I wanted to take a moment and talk about film technology. I've mentioned a few times that the standard size of film used to project movies is 35mm, but I haven't really explained what that means or why that is. In the next two episodes, this will become more important, so I'd like to explain it now. The 35 and 35mm describes the left-to-right width, also called the gauge, of an individual frame. The height of this unit is 24mm, creating the standard size and rectangular shape that allows individual frames to be exposed and projected through virtually all recording and presentation devices that use the standard. These individual frames are, of course, on rolls of thousands, and are the building blocks that make up movies. An important thing to note, though, is that 35mm refers to the size of the whole individual unit of plastic we just described, not the image that's actually contained on that plastic. The actual image that makes up the movie sits in the center of the film, framed top and bottom by unexposed film, and left and right by sprocket holes used to pull the film through the camera or the projector vertically. Now, I haven't read this anywhere, but I would assume that this apparent framing of an image in the center of unexposed film is where the term film frame actually comes from. The actual image contained in 35mm film, in imperial measurements, is 1 inch wide by 0.75 inches tall. This creates the familiar 4:3 aspect ratio, squarish image that would be the standard aspect ratio for film until the dawn of widescreen in the 1950s. Incredibly, this tiny 1-inch image contains all the detail needed to project a movie onto a 45 to 65-foot diameter screen at a movie theater. This is because the amount of detail captured on physical film is mostly only limited by the actual microscopic size of the silver crystals that form on it during development. The size of these silver crystals and the ways that they form create what is called the grain of the film. If you're watching old movies and notice what looks like a slight amount of static on lighter areas of the picture, what you're seeing is the tiny crystals that make up the image, which develop differently frame by frame, flickering across the screen at an incredible rate. If you'd like to learn more about it, I'll put a really helpful video all about film and film grain and how it works on the show's website, historyoffilmpodcast.com. Now that we know what 35mm film actually is, we need to answer another question. How did 35mm become the standard for film? Well, I'm sorry to disappoint, but the answer is kind of boring. Thomas Edison and W. K. L. Dixon designed their kinetograph and kinetoscope machines to use 35mm film. Because Edison had connections with Eastman Kodak, Edison had Kodak produce gobs and gobs of film that met his machine standards. Kodak was all too happy to do it, because they were already producing film of a 70mm gauge, so they would just have to chop it in half to create their new motion picture standard. With almost no effort, Kodak could convert their existing product into one that met the needs of an entirely new market. It made good business sense. Edison used his clout in the industry to force the adoption of his patented 35mm film standard, and by the time his tyrannical reign as the despot of film was over, 35mm was entrenched and became the standard of film in the United States. Similarly, the Lumiere brothers of France and the Blair Company of Great Britain produced the film that their countries relied on, and they produced, you guessed it, 35mm film. So, in brief, 35mm was the gauge of film that filmmakers had access to and was enforced by Edison, which we will talk about in future episodes. In other words, 35mm film is the standard, because it is. There were, of course, other competing theatrical production gauges developed in the early days of film, but these are so tangential that they don't fall within the scope of this program. So remember that, unless I note otherwise, all the movies we talk about are going to be 35mm. Now we get to move on and talk about Edwin S. Porter. Edwin Stanton Porter is one of those guys who shows up prominently in like every film history textbook, and whose work and achievements are widely recognized and still referenced by filmmakers in movies today. Porter's films are particularly memorable for how modern they can sometimes feel, and Porter is usually credited with inventing key pieces of cinematic language that have shaped movies ever since. This is true, but it is also true that Porter's work was influenced by filmmakers from across the world that were working concurrently to him, just like everyone else. Edwin S. Porter was born on the 21st of April, 1870, in Cornellsville, Pennsylvania, in the northeastern United States. Born under the name Edward Porter, he was the fourth of seven children. Porter's family was solidly middle class, his father being a modest business owner and cabinet maker in their hometown. Upon reaching adulthood, Porter changed his name from Edward to Edwin, claiming his namesake was Edwin Stanton, American President Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of War. Porter's early adulthood leaves an impression of restlessness. His several early careers include telegraph operator, electrical engineer, owning a tailoring business, and serving in the United States Navy. After Porter's time in the Navy ended, he found himself thrust into the world of motion pictures. Some of Porter's friends had bought the rights to display Edison's Vitagraph films in Indiana and California, and Porter was hired on as a projectionist. Taking the position proved to be fortuitous, as Porter's work as a projectionist opened opportunities for him to display films in distant locales, including the Caribbean and Canada, before finally winding back up in the Northeast United States. He worked as a projectionist for the Wax Museum Eden Musée before finally entering the employ of Thomas Edison. According to his entry in the Encyclopedia Britannica, Porter was initially hired to, quote, make improvements and redesign the Edison Company's motion picture equipment. Quickly, though, Porter moved behind the camera and became one of the early cameraman directors of the cinema. Porter made many movies, and several of them are very important, so strap in. We're going to start with his 1901 film, Uncle Josh at the Moving Picture Show. As I was doing research on this movie, I found that the Library of Congress website has the original description of the film as contained in Edison's film catalog. It's not very long, and I would like to take the opportunity to read it to you so you could see how the movie was actually described by its production company in 1902. As I'm reading this, try to imagine one of those great old New England accents being pitched to early potential buyers. From the Edison catalog, quote, "Here we present a side splitter. Uncle Josh occupies a box at a vaudeville theater, and a moving picture show is going on. First, there appears upon the screen a dancer. Uncle Josh jumps to the stage and endeavors to make love to her, but she flits away. And immediately there appears upon the screen a picture of an express train running at 60 miles an hour. Uncle Josh here becomes panic-stricken, and fearing to be struck by the train, makes a dash for his box. He no sooner is seated than a country couple appears upon the screen as well. Before they pump a pail of water, they indulge in a lovemaking scene. Uncle Josh evidently thinks he recognizes his own daughter, and jumping again upon the stage, he removes his coat and prepares to chastise the lover. And grabbing the moving picture screen, he hauls it down. And to his great surprise, he finds a kinetoscope operator in the rear. The operator is made furious by Uncle Josh interrupting his show, and grabbing him, they roll over and over on the stage in an exciting encounter. Class A, 125 feet. Uncle Josh is a funny enough movie, and it plays with some of the exaggerated ideas about film that by 1901, movies were already starting to outgrow. Uncle Josh appears to be hyper-impressed with the supposed reality that the movies are showing him. Instead of feeling like he's actually at a live vaudeville performance, he seems to believe there is actually a giant woman dancing in front of him. Instead of feeling nervous at the image of an oncoming train, Uncle Josh flees in terror from it. In his anger at the young lovers on the screen, Uncle Josh unwittingly tears down the screen. Now, this movie was 120 years ago what it is today, a comedy poking fun at a foolish man who is myopically unable to understand that movies aren't real. But remember, According to ever dubious legend, the Lumiere film The Train Arrives at the Station terrified its audiences in 1896, just 5 years before Uncle Josh at the Moving Picture Show was released. Perhaps in 1901, the idea of a first-time filmgoer not exactly understanding what was happening on screen was easier to believe. Only a half a decade after the first projected films, we already have a movie directly about how movies aren't real, and pointing out that movies themselves are illusions, not to be understood as literal truth. It is an important step away from the supposed reality the earliest films tried to emulate. Perhaps more important than the implications of the content in Uncle Josh is the content itself. This movie is one of the first, if not the first, pieces of cinema to have a film within a film in it. Uncle Josh helps build a precedent that we are still seeing today. Filmmakers are obsessed with movies, and their art reflects that. And this doesn't just apply to specific movies being referenced, such as we've already seen with Alice Guy citing her own earlier work, but in the wider sense that movies often play themselves, taking in film viewership as a common subject or narrative device. Uncle Josh at the Moving Picture Show is the ancient ancestor of films like Cinema Paradiso, Scream, Inglourious Basterds, The Purple Rose of Cairo, and Tampopo, along with many, many others. To a lesser extent, any movie with a movie in it can trace its origins right here. It's an impressive legacy. All the way back in episode 8, we learned about the films and the achievements of the Brighton School film movement in England. When examining Porter's upcoming body of work, it's clear that he had at least seen some of the films that the Brighton School was producing. Writers differ on the amount of influence the Brighton films had on Porter. The ever-incendiary David Shipman wrote in The Story of Cinema that, quote, "Porter was merely another plagiarist in an industry now founded on that principle. And indeed, one of his jobs was to study imported films for ideas." Most writers, though, seem to be more generous towards Porter's own creativity, giving him credit for his use of and iterations on Brighton School techniques. In our case, I will describe the important features of Porter's films and cite other films that set the precedent for them. Hopefully, this will show how filmmakers are influenced by their peers from all across the world when creating their own work. We will start with Porter's Life of an American Fireman. The 1903 film Life of an American Fireman is clearly inspired by James Williamson's 1901 movie Fire, sharing both a subject and some similar shots. In Porter's film, a fireman dreams of a woman and child, which is ostensibly his family, before we see a close-up of a fire alarm being pulled. Alerted to this new danger, all the firemen asleep at the fire station leap from their beds, quickly dress, and slide down the fire pole. Now on the ground floor, they get their horse teams ready and rush off to fight the fire. After quite a long time watching the horses pull their carts, the camera pans left and we see a burning house. We cut inside to see a frightened woman, who quickly passes out. This appears to be the same woman we saw in the fireman's dream at the beginning of the film. With her life in peril and not a moment to spare, a fireman bursts through the door of her second-story bedroom, uses his hatchet to destroy the exterior window, grabs the woman and child, and lowers them to the ground safely using a ladder set by the other fireman outside. We then see the same action we just saw, the fireman rescuing the woman, repeated, but from outside the house. So we see a frightened woman at the window, the fireman setting up the ladder outside, and the brave hero who rescues the woman and child, carrying them down the ladder to safety outside the burning building. There are a few technical aspects of this movie that bear mentioning before we talk about this movie's wider place in film history. This film is an excellent opportunity to talk about some of the innovations that were happening at this time, but have not yet come up in our overarching story. First is the influence of European cinema on this American movie. The opening shot of the film, in which the fireman dreams of what is probably his family, looks like it was achieved by some kind of masking and double exposure. We've seen very similar techniques used in George Albert Smith's 1898 film Santa Claus, used to show a little girl in the movie dreaming, and in Ferdinand Zecca's 1901 film History of a Crime, in which a man about to be hung recalls the events that would lead to his execution. This technique and its narrative uses, dreaming, remembering, etc., is beginning to become one of the most basic tools filmmakers use when creating their movies. We also see a close-up of a fire alarm being pulled. which was also pioneered by George Albert Smith. This close-up, as well as a mixture of medium and wide shots, provides an early taste of the variety of shots that moviegoers would come to expect. We also see a kind of camera movement I haven't talked about yet on this show, the pan. In the third edition of Film, A Critical Introduction, a pan is defined as, quote, the horizontal turning movement of an otherwise immobile camera across a scene from left to right or vice versa. This little move is easy to try at home. If you have a tripod, set it up, put a camera on it, and move the arm left or right. That's a pan. If you don't have a tripod, you can try it this way. Hold a camera still in your hand, with your arm in front of you, bent up at a 90-degree angle. Now just turn your wrist, keeping the rest of your arm as still as possible. That's a pan. Pans can be used for lots of different things, often to follow action, or allow an audience to understand more about a location than could be comprehended through just a static camera placement. Camera movement can also affect the feeling an audience has when watching a scene. A slow pan across a dramatic situation can be heart-wrenching, but pans can also be funny. A pan is a movement that's very much like moving your own head, so when used this way, it can make the audience feel like they're looking over to notice something that's just off-screen. See the 2014 film The Grand Budapest Hotel for good examples. While this is the first time we have talked about the pan in this show, it is not the first pan in film history. The pan appears to have originated out of necessity. As described in John Gartenberg in his article Camera Movement in Edison and Biograph Films 1900-1906, Gartenberg writes that camera movements weren't initially needed by filmmakers, as what they were filming was always shot indoors and was pre-planned. So they simply planned to film things that could be kept in frame the entire time. Camera movements became necessary as movies began to be filmed outside. In a less controlled environment, filmmakers would sometimes have to move their cameras to keep the subject of the film on screen. These initial accidental experimentations in film movement began to be incorporated into and motivated by the stories that were being recorded. This is the case in lots of movies, such as the 1900 film Love in the Suburbs, in which two men follow a woman while the camera pans to keep up with them, or the 1901 film The Photographer's Mishap, in which the camera pans to reveal a space in which a photographer can escape the path of an oncoming train. This story resolution wouldn't have made much sense or have been very interesting if the camera didn't pan, as the photographer would have just stepped off screen. In the case of Life of an American Fireman, the camera movement serves a dual function. The camera pans left to keep a carriage of firefighters on screen, while at the same time transforming the long shot of the carriage rushing to its destination into an establishing shot of the burning building. This little bit of camera movement adds a lot to the movie, and was still uncommon in 1903, though it would quickly become ubiquitous. I didn't mention this earlier when describing the film, but there's also an excellent early example of a new kind of editing in Life of an American Fireman, the fade. We have to talk about this one for a while to describe what it is and how it's used, and then we'll swing back around and describe it in the context of how it's used in Life of an American Fireman. Unlike the cut, which is an instantaneous visual transition from one piece of film to another, the fade takes its time, usually a second or two to accomplish in full. The fade comes in three flavors: the fade out, in which the image transitions to black, the fade in which a black screen brightens to an image, and the crossfade, more commonly called a dissolve, in which an image fades directly into another with no period of darkness in between. Through most of film history, the fade has been accomplished through an optical printer, and now through nonlinear video editing software. But in the early days, the fade was an in-camera effect. According to David A. Cook, whose work has been extremely valuable when writing this episode, this effect was originally achieved by a camera shutter closing gradually for a fade out and opening gradually for a fade in. The film could then be rolled back and double exposed during both processes to create a dissolve. Other sources written about general film editing much later cite the same effect being achieved not with a shutter but with the camera's aperture, which makes much more sense to me, but that may have only been possible later due to improvements in camera technology throughout the history of film. The fade and the dissolve serve different purposes than cinema's most versatile editing technique, the cut, The cut is so versatile that I expect we'll have to do a whole episode about it in order to really understand its uses throughout film history. The fade, however, is more limited, and we can describe it right here. In a funny little book from the 1950s published by Kodak, fades and dissolves are described decently well in this way, quote, "A dissolve is a method by which to carry the eye and the mind from one phase of a subject to another phase of the same subject. A fade out should be used to indicate the ending of a series of shots of one subject, and a fade in to introduce a new subject. A fade out can also be used to indicate a lapse of time." In other words, fades are understood by film audiences to mean we're done here in time, place, subject, or all three. It's a beginning or an end. Dissolves usually mean we're moving on and ask the audience to do the same thing, but with less pause in the action and does not allow the audience to have a clear separation between the two scenes which are dissolving into each other. It's a change of time and space, but not a beginning or an end. Unlike the cut, the dissolve and the fade are virtually always used to denote the beginning or the ending of a scene. As you would expect, Life of an American Fireman does use fades this way, but with much less nuance. Porter actually uses fades as his only kind of editing in this movie. Shots go like this. The fireman dreams of a woman and child. Fade out. Fade in on the fire alarm being pulled. Fade out. Fade in on the fireman being awakened and sliding down the fire pole. Fade out. Fade in on the fireman sliding down the pole and getting the carts and horses ready on the ground floor. Fade out. Fade in on the horses and carts leaving the fire station, and so on, and so on. Now, the movie isn't quite as tedious as I just made it sound, it's actually quite good, but it is clear from a modern perspective, cuts would have served better than fades in many instances. However, there are some fades that actually work extremely well. The first one, transitioning from the sleeping fireman to the fire alarm being pulled, is perfectly natural. And the transition from the smoky exterior shot of the burning house to the smoky interior shot of the burning house is seamless. Now, I don't believe Porter's work here is the first fade, which is hard to pin down. But it is an excellent example of how transitions and new editing techniques were beginning to be used in this period. As film grew up, so did its grammar as achieved through different editing techniques, and the fade will be part of our entire story going forward. Yet another important feature of this movie is its mixture of types of footage. Life of an American Fireman has some real documentary footage of firemen at work. Sources differ on how Porter obtained this footage, with some stating that he and a film crew waited with a team of firemen until they were called to action and recorded them at work, while others describe Porter using already recorded footage from other Edison films. Either way, this mixture of documentary and stage footage adds realism to the film, and was a new idea at the time of American Fireman's release. Finally, one of the most important reasons Life of an American Fireman is so remembered today is what it teaches us about how the earliest filmmakers and filmgoers thought about movies and what they expected from them. Life of an American Fireman was a lost film for decades, until the American Museum of Modern Art acquired a copy from the Pathé Film Company in the 1940s. The print that the MOMA acquired was not the original version of the film, but rather one that had the two separate interior and exterior rescue sequences cut together into one long rescue. This made Life of an American Fireman an extremely important film, as it appeared to be the earliest known example of significant parallel editing. Parallel editing is going to be the focus of the rest of the episode, so let's take the time to describe it. Parallel editing is defined as a technique of cutting back and forth between action occurring in two different locations, which often creates the illusion they are happening simultaneously. Or, as Mark Cousins states in the first episode of his documentary series, The History of Film and Odyssey, if continuity editing, which we talked about last time, can be described as the cinematic word then, parallel editing can be described as the cinematic word meanwhile. It can seem a little strange when you think about it, but your brain really does understand that one short cut in the middle of another shot is happening during the shot it is sandwiched in between. One of the best examples of this ever is the climactic baptism scene from Francis Ford Coppola's 1972 film, The Godfather. Or on a whole other scale, like the entire ending of Rob Reiner's The Princess Bride from 1987, where whole scenes made of many different shots run parallel to each other. Really, it happens constantly, and most of the movies you've ever seen use this technique. Parallel editing has lots of different uses, but the MOMA print of Life of an American Fireman uses it one of the ways it is most common, to build a sense of immediacy and tension. In a departure from the lackadaisical fades which we see in the rest of the movie, these cuts were stunningly like early modern film, but appeared to predate most other known usages of the technique by years. That is, if you don't count James Williamson's Fire, which used a much less sophisticated kind of parallel editing in 1901, to paraphrase the aforementioned David A. Cook in his book A History of Narrative Film. Because this was the only known print of Life of an American Fireman, Porter's movie was accepted as an extremely remarkable film, which had the first successful use of advanced parallel editing. But the story, of course, doesn't end there. Later, a copyright print found in the Library of Congress and another original print found in the state of Maine revealed what we now know to be the original structure of the film. The entire rescue scene, viewed from inside the burning house, followed by the same scene viewed again from the outside of the house. This changed the perceived track of film history. No longer was Life of an American Fireman a portentous forerunner of film's glorious cinematic future, but an antiquated relic that had been re-edited at some point to make it more palatable to film audiences sometime after its original release. This, in some ways, diminished Porter's perceived genius, though his work is still enshrined in just about every film history book I have. In other ways, though, it has become a different kind of classic, helping modern students of film history understand the very different ways movies were perceived in the early 20th century. As we've already covered in this program, early movies didn't exist to tell stories, but rather as spectacle-based entertainments that drew audiences to them from the sheer novelty of being a moving picture, or showing an interesting recording. Life of an American Fireman shows the transition between these two kinds of cinema, storytelling and spectacle. There's a story, sure, but it's not entirely clear based off the image alone. And the movie clearly puts more emphasis on watching the firemen get ready and the documentary footage of them rushing to the scene of a fire than it does the story that we're presented. It also shows us that modern cinematic conventions of understanding time could have developed completely differently and were understood differently by audiences in 1903. In the second edition of A History of Narrative Film, Cook suggests that the reason this kind of editing, which lacked intercutting, would have made sense to audiences in 1903 was a fundamental difference in how filmgoers saw movies. According to Cook, audiences then saw films not as one whole piece of art, as we do now, but as a series of individual moving pictures strung together to tell stories. Imagine a story being told in a comic book or a slideshow presentation. In these cases, switching back and forth between the same slides wouldn't be appealing, but showing one perspective on one slide and then another perspective on another slide would be much more so. As such, the kind of parallel editing and cross-cutting between shots that would become commonplace simply didn't fit the basic understanding of filmmakers and cinemagoers at the time. If the modern conception of parallel editing was used here, it would imply that audiences were already beginning to understand movies to be a unified piece of art, which it seems they were not. Porter made another movie that demonstrates this point really well, which we will talk about next week. I would also like to note that this information was omitted from the third edition of A History of Narrative Film. I'm not sure why this was the case, as I find these ideas extremely compelling. Because of the rediscovery of the original, unaltered print, Life of an American Fireman has changed its place in film history. Rather than being one of the first modern films, it has become an important part of film's fossil record, showing the transitions cinema was going through and growing out of in this period. My plan for this episode was to cover all of Porter's work so we could move on to the development of the Edison Trust next week, but that simply will not be possible. After all, if we moved on now, we wouldn't even have covered Porter's most important movie. So, instead, next week there will be another Edwin S. Porter episode, as we cover one of the most influential films ever made. And believe me, it's going to be great. Thank you for listening to this episode of The History of Film. These episodes keep getting longer and longer, which I suppose is a good thing, but they are getting a little hard to write. Thank you for your patience in waiting for this one. If you'd like to support the show, the best way you could do that is leaving a review wherever you listen and telling your friends about it. To view the movies we talked about this week and other helpful resources, you can visit historyoffilmpodcast.com, where I've posted all of them under the episode 12 notes. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at historyoffilmpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and join me next week for another exciting episode of the History of Film.